Frizzell
with his wonderful way of playing a guitar. Very different and so beautiful. It's a tune he calls Where Do We Go? And I thought it to be appropriate for our discussion today. It's from his 2001 album, Blues Dream. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we're picking up from where we left off with each other yesterday, as promised, and we'll be talking about this question that has been hounding us since, I suppose, the time that African Americans won the so-called right to vote, and what becomes of the potential of political power. Well, before I get to that, just a note to keep you up to date. We are still, our phone system is not working as it ought to, and so we are on a parallel track electronically so that we can get the program done. But what that means is that we won't be able to talk with each other for probably another couple of days. So bear with that, would you please? And once we get back on, you know, things will be just fine. But in the meantime, this is one of the things we have to endure. Not a bad problem, but something that I need you to know, because, of course, you know, we do like talking to each other. Roy Moore, who lost the U.S. Senate race in Alabama to Democrat Doug Jones in a special election this past Tuesday, says he's not conceding until the vote is fully tallied, fully counted, to include military and write-in ballots. With 99% of the votes counted, those votes, the military and write-in votes, an estimated 20,000 of them, won't be enough to put Moore over the top, even if they all went to him, according to officials. Besides, under Alabama law, the difference between the final votes in an election between the candidates must be smaller than 0.5% in order to trigger an automatic recount. All the same, Roy Moore is saying, I am not conceding. I do not believe. And further, he says he does not believe the tallies so far. He believes that there has been a gross miscount. And despite Alabama law about that 0.5% triggering an automatic recount, and he's not at that level based on the official count so far, he says he's just going to wait and see what happens. So although Doug Jones has been declared the winner, in the mind of Roy Moore and the people who support him, it ain't over. African Americans in this race delivered victory for Jones, but as we said yesterday, we have to really look into that issue. We have to revisit it, not to question who won and who lost in the final sense, but to start from the point that the African-American vote was decisive. Whichever way it turns out to be finally, the African-American vote was decisive in that race, and it gave victory to the Democrat, Doug Jones. Well, of what benefit will the African-American decisive vote be to them? That's the question that we raised yesterday. And I raised it because this is yet another example, yet another time when the African American vote proves to be decisive in victories, especially going to Democrats. And yet, we haven't been able to answer the question of what benefit have these decisive victories been to the community that delivered it. And behind that is the suggestion that African Americans are not voting with a purpose in mind, with a strategy in mind. They're not demanding anything in exchange for their vote. They're just shepherded like sheep, and shepherded into the corral, to the containment, and with instructions to do a particular thing, and then they do it, and then they go home. The leadership, both the African American leadership and the party leadership, don't particularly care to instruct on what the benefit is to voters, African American voters particularly, about what it is that they will commit to doing, not just theoretically, but actually commit to doing. And so we have what I believe is just a kind of, it's a disgrace, actually. It is a disgrace that this process historically is not of great benefit to this community. It was when the right to vote was an essential fixture in political races, the right to vote of African Americans. People actually competed in some cases for the vote, both Republican and Democrat. And we had the African American leadership stepping forward and taking on the task of voter education, not just voter registration, but voter education, instructing a community that had been cut out deliberately, that had been ignored deliberately, that had been deprived of its constitutional rights on this matter of voting. So in the early stages, African American voters were very conscientious about voting. But even so, it was a rare thing where the leadership stepped up to the plate to actually engage in voter education. What is the purpose for you casting a vote? What does that mean for you? What does that mean for your community? What does that mean for your well-being? Not just now, but in the future, because this is a process that is continuing, one assumes. The voting process is a continuing process because the dynamics of life in the United States require that we are sensitive to our interests in voting. But that was abandoned because, frankly, it was too much work for the leadership. They didn't want to do that. The leadership became compromised. They went into the Democratic Party like sheep after a while, not with a sense of purpose, not with a sense of history and not with a sense of the future. In other words, they didn't want the responsibility of leadership. They just wanted leadership. And sadly, this came to be the norm. When African Americans began to vote, immediately in their consciences was the life that their community, they and their community were living, the opportunities that were denied them, the quest for parity, the realization that a vote today could instruct what would happen tomorrow. So it was a process, a continuing process, with an eye toward gains, increasing gains, and the vote an instrument of investment in the future. That's done for all intents and purposes now, because African Americans believe, despite the evidence, daily evidence, they still believe that they are true Americans and that the process has integrity, that they will not be harmed, that their vote will be respected and not be a chit on some political table in a back room somewhere. The leadership is compromised for the, I mean, it's the only word I can use. For the most part, they have surrendered, and in some cases, happily surrendered, what is potentially enormous power to a system that derides them, despises them, and the communities they represent. It is still very much a white world in this country. And we have African American leaders, many, way too many of them, siding against their communities. But then we look at this race and we can extract something in the way of instruction for us as we go forward. And that is, there is to be no doubt now, there should be no doubt about the potentiality of power within the African American community. No doubt about it. I'm sure that Doug Jones is a very nice man, and I'm sure that he, in his way, has tried to do the right thing in his life, but he comes from a community that is suspect, as far as an African-American voter should be concerned. We're hearing references to him being a prosecutor, and this was one of the draws for him, for black support, that the bombing of the church in Birmingham, where six little girls died, he was a prosecutor in that case. And it remains an emotional tug for African Americans and their leaders in Birmingham. I say, yes, he was the prosecutor, but he was also doing his job. There's no need to be overwhelmingly emotional about it. That was his job as a prosecutor, to go find the killer or killers of these little girls. That was in accordance with his responsibilities as a prosecutor. It does not make him extraordinarily special. It just makes him a guy who was elected or who put in place to do this job, and he proceeded to do his job. And that's he's to be commended for doing his job. That's how I see it. And from all those years ago, to have that currency still have value today, but in a very different way for African Americans, their leadership has overstated this particular job that he did. And obviously, I think when you look at it, he was a better choice. He was a better choice than, say, electing Roy Moore. I think he was a better choice. But it had to do with other factors. Number one, there wasn't a great deal of choice in this race to begin with. And should we not ask the question, which some would say, well, you know, that's being racist. But it is a direct question and a valid one. Why is it that after all these years, an African-American Senate leader can't be produced, especially at this time? Why is that the case? That despite all the other indications that of the potentiality of power within the black community still does not have a leader reflecting its values, its history, its needs. Now, suddenly people will say, well, that's a racist question. Are you saying that only black people should have been black people should have an edge on being senator? I say, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, they ought to have an edge. But the leaders can't produce one. The leaders cannot produce a viable black candidate. The party will not produce a viable black candidate. So we're still stuck with that dynamic, that no matter where you, what case you make, no matter the evident need, no matter the common sense in that strategy of electing, or at least bringing to the fore, a viable black candidate after all these years, which would have signified change, political change. So the leadership did not have the foresight. It did not have the guts to engage in a political battle. And the political battle was not about endorsing the better of two white candidates. The battle was producing a compatible candidate for the community that, as we saw, delivered victory. That would have been a wonderful thing to do, and a practical thing to do, and a smart thing to do, and a strategic thing to do. But nobody's thinking down there. It can't be allowed. As we move ahead, it cannot be allowed that there is no change to the standard political formula. We will rejoice that black folks are voting, but they're voting for the wrong person. They're voting for the wrong things. There is no strategy in their vote, which makes them political sheep. And we can't afford to be political sheep anymore. If there's to be one signal of progress, it is that we should see a plethora of other faces, Latino faces, Asian faces, women, and so forth, who have deliberately been barred from fully participating in the political process, so that those communities from which they come can see a benefit to voting. They're making an investment in their future. But this is not what happened in Birmingham, and this is not what is happening across the country. The black leadership, for the most part, as I said, being compromised, they're now taking instructions. They still continue to take instructions from people who have a vested interest in containing black progress. I refer to you, I talked about it, the effort by the Texas Congressman Al Green. Here is a person who says that the presidential leadership is really putrid, and it's got to go. It is compromised in so many ways. And that's what his constituency wants. They want him to do something to affect that. So he puts together articles of impeachment against the President of the United States. And as he stands there on the floor of the House reading his articles of impeachment and making it clear that he intends to bring more articles of impeachment, there was nobody standing with him. And yet, there isn't a single black legislator, really, who can say heartfully that Donald Trump is the best choice for President of the United States. There you go. And when the vote came up, there was nobody really standing at his side, from even his own caucus. So African Americans, because of the cowardice of their leadership, did not have, through this move, an expression of disaffection with the president and the process. Totally locked out, but by design. Everybody followed the instructions of Nancy Pelosi, who thinks that the party is her personal property, and that the Democratic Party leadership really is white, and as nice and flowery as she sounds, and very soft and feminine, you look at the history where she is usually at odds with the political decisions being made at the lower level, the community level. They are completely incompatible, but it continues. So it's time for African Americans to take stock, to grow up, and to see that their interests are not being represented, although they have done the job of lifting people up into circles of power who have, as a second thought at best, the interests of their community. We've got to be careful about that, that we should not be ashamed, nor should we be reticent about flexing the political muscles that we have. And this is the case of the Senate race in Alabama. It brought victory to somebody. And if it could bring victory to Doug Jones, it certainly could bring victory to Leroy Jones. You know what I mean? It's power. You have it. You can see it. It meant something. And that is the reality of it. I'll take a little break now and come back to a very instructive part of the program right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. And I want to, because I like connecting dots so that people aren't believing that a thing happens in and of itself and it is related to nothing. Well, this discussion that I'm having with you today is related to something. And it's related to instructions that we got from Kwame Ture, the late Kwame Ture. And what he said is, and what he had always been stressing, is the need for proper organization and proper education in order to achieve proper progress. I want to share with you an address he gave at the University of Chicago in 1989, in which he talks about strategy and purpose informing political action. And if we don't link these things together and move forward on these bedrock principles, we will only be enabling our own oppression. And do not be fooled. This recent victory in Alabama, while it is being sold to people as, you know, a wonderful thing, actually is an oppressive move, if people really stop to think about it. Here's Kwame Ture in 1989. At the University of Chicago.
We thank you for your welcome. We have been allotted half an hour, and within this half an hour, we are to explain some of the lessons of the movement of the 60s and its relationships to the 80s and relevance to the 21st century. I have picked about five areas that I have picked about five areas which I would like to discuss. The first lesson that we can come to look from the 60 and gain is the understanding that the statement made by Abraham Lincoln is a true statement. You can fool some of the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all of the people all of the time. This statement can be understood within the context of United States imperialism and its role in the late 50s. In the late 50s, based on the resolutions passed at the 5th Pan-African Congress in 1945, a decision was made that Africans the world over must create mass organizations and mass movements to confront colonialism in Africa and the Caribbean in the final round, and also to confront racism and economic exploitation in the United States. From 1945 to 1960, within 15 short years of this conference, over 230 million Africans were to gain independence. Swiftly following in that wake, the Caribbean was to light a fire with independence movement, and of course the United States of America itself, beginning its mass movement since the mid-50s with Martin Luther King and the Montgomery boycott, came to show mass movements everywhere. The American capitalist system, in the wake of the independence struggle in Africa, was trying everywhere to demonstrate to countries just struggling against colonial powers in Europe that it was not like the European powers, that it was not racist, it was democratic, it never had colonies, etc., etc. The African masses in America came to put that lie to rest quickly. Mass struggle inside the country came to demonstrate before the entire world that America was far from being a democratic country. It came to demonstrate, in fact, that countries in Africa were much further advanced in democracy than America ever was. Here, at least, Africans can vote. In America, they could not. One of the lessons, then, that we must draw squarely from the 60s is an understanding that real struggle must be left and must be understood only by the masses of the people. It is the masses of the people who could not believe the lies of America and came to struggle instinctively against these lies. This instinctive struggle must be properly understood. History, of course, is made both consciously and unconsciously. Last month in Miami, Africans came to unconsciously make history by revolting against brutal conditions and pushing humanity forward. But this was instinctive, unconscious, unplanned. Indeed, this is the same aspect of the struggle that we saw in the 60s, instinctive struggle. Thus, if we were to draw a conclusion just from this aspect of struggle, that is to say, the people struggling unconsciously, unplanned, spontaneously, and instinctively, that since people have an instinctive love of freedom, everywhere they will struggle for freedom. The history of Africans in America proved this clearly. Nowhere have they consciously organized to make advance. All the advances they have made have been unconscious, instinctive, and spontaneous. Certainly, you can understand what will happen when these people become thoroughly organized. The lessons, then, must be clear. Human beings, like animals of the lower form, have instincts. Human beings, unlike animals of the lower form, have the ability to think and reason. The lesson, then, must be clear. All of our instincts, at all times, under all conditions, must be governed by reason. The instinctive struggle of the 60s, the spontaneous struggle of the 60s, the unconscious struggle of the 60s, if they are to serve to us as lessons, must come to be qualified in conscious movements, rational movements, and planned movements. This, then, seems to me to be the first lesson that we would have to acquire from the 60s. Of course, the capitalist system lies all the time. Some people think it lies some of the time, but it lies all of the time. And in lying, it has an attempt to make us think that in the 60s we were an organized people and everything was all right. We were not organized. We were a mobilized people. Thus, are we to get a heavy lesson from the 60s? The lessons must be clear. A mobilized people, really, an instinctive people, a spontaneous people who struggle like animals. Even if we take the example of Miami, we can see it clearly here. In Miami, we're oppressed just like we are everywhere else. But we wait until an outside force provokes us into action. Everywhere you will see us, it is always an outside force that provokes the African masses into action, even on the campus here. I told some brothers the other day, you want to organize all the African students on the campus? I can do it overnight. All I got to do is write a filthy sign derogatory against them, put them on the campus. Next day, they all come to the meeting. And one of the errors that must be corrected, a people struggling for their freedom cannot depend upon an external force to push them into motion. They must have an internal dynamism of their own. Consequently, the African masses, in drawing lessons from the 60s, must come clearly to understand that they must have a dynamism in their hands that tell them when to attack the enemy, how to attack the enemy, and where to carry their struggle. Thus, the 60s must come to be qualified from a mobilized struggle to an organized struggle. We say they fight like animals. You back an animal up against a wall, and the animal, even a rabbit, will come out striking at you until you back up. Thus Africans, once provoked, come out striking wildly as they do in Miami. The police retreat, give them some concessions, they sit down, and then the police comes back with more repression. None of the gains made by a mobilized people can be maintained. It is only an organized people who can make gains and use those gains to further their struggle. Indeed, the gains made by the 60s, since they were made by an unorganized people in a state of mobilization, have not been used by the people, but in fact used by the enemy against the people. It is clear for the history of Africans in America that unlike others in this country, the history is not the same, entirely different from everybody else. All those who came here expecting a better life. An African put on a slave ship from Africa knew he was coming to hell. It's a fact. Consequently, the relationship between the country cannot be the same unless this African has lost consciousness of his history and think that he came on the Mayflower. This aspect of organization from mobilization must be properly understood. No individual African in this country makes any advancement based on his individual talents or worth. All individual advancements are based on mass struggle. This must be properly understood and can be properly underlined for you once you know the history of Africans is not the same as the history of others. We make no progress in this country without shedding our blood. No one sitting in this audience can give me one example where Africans in this country have made any progress without shedding their blood. In order for them to get into a filthy 5 and 10 cent store, they must shed their blood. In order to sit on a bus where they pay the same amount as everybody else do, they must shed their blood. In order to get their children into state schools where they pay taxes more than anybody else, they must shed their blood. In order to get the vote which every immigrant gets the minute he comes here, they must shed their blood. Consequently, any advances made by any individual African is made as a result of mass struggle. Thus, that position does not belong to the individual African, it belongs to the people. Failure to use this position for the benefit of the people is a betrayal of the blood of the people. Consequently, when we come to correct the 60s and look properly at the lessons, we must become an organized people who, once having made gains, are capable of choosing for ourselves who will occupy those gains. They come to talk about some man named Brown who's going to be head of the Democratic Party. Who picked him?
Yes,
who picked him? Did the African masses in the Democratic Party pick him? Not at all. As a matter of fact, the Democratic Party holds the Africans in great contempt. They have more elected positions than any other ethnic group in the Democratic Party and has no power in the party at all. They have 302 mayors, 20 congresspeople, 5,000 state, county, local. No other ethnic group in this country has those many elected officials, and still they have no power in the Democratic Party. Why? Because we are not organized. Consequently, to transform our movement, to push it to higher levels, which it must go, because we will arrive at our freedom, if even instinctively, we must come here to put ration and clear reasoning to our struggle and organize the masses of our people. The second lesson we wish to speak of is the role of students. Students, of course, have a role in any society, capitalist society, socialist society, and their role is to institutionalize the values of the given society. Of course, in a capitalist system, this should be done unconsciously. But students are the spark of revolution. Of course, we make a difference here between revolution and reform. Those who want reform seek to work, I guess, from the top down. Those of us who understand fundamental changes know it must come from the bottom up. The students, of course, always work at the point of ideas in a society. Their job is to acquire knowledge, and of course, this knowledge which they acquired is geared by an ideology which tells them what to do with it. So if you're a doctor, instead of curing cancer, you should turn a man to a woman to get money, even though she can't make babies. That was life. Students, we say, at the point of ideas and the point of values. When one speaks of revolution, one speaks of overturning the values of a given society. If one is not speaking of overturning the values, then one speaks of reform. Thus, one can join the Democratic Party. We're not here to overturn its value. But certainly, if one is here for revolution and one is here for people's liberation, one would know that a corrupt instrument can never lead a people to liberation at all. Students, then, we say, come to question the values of a society. Of course, in relationship to the values, students, just like anyone in any society, have but two alternatives. Either they accept the values or they reject the values. It's as simple as that. Of course, if they reject the values, they have a responsibility to find alternative values. But either you accept cheating as a student or you reject it. It's as simple as that. Either you accept any value in a society or you reject it. Students, once having rejected a society, bringing together their ideas and their energies and strength to work against these values, connected with the masses, always give us revolution. Thus, from the 60s, while a reform movement, we were able to see that students, joined with the masses of the people, came to bring a lot of changes to the country. Thus, we must not confuse ourselves. The job of students are clear here. Their job is to spark revolution. Students cannot carry revolution through to the end. The final triumph of revolution must be carried through to the end by the masses, the workers, and the peasants. But students play a crucial role. We say they spark revolution. Certainly, if we did not recognize this, the enemy did. The FBI, before the 60s, did not have informers on college campus. After the 60s, they put an informer on every college campus in the country. Their job was simple: stop any activity at all that runs against the status quo. We say it's the mobilized people who can allow this, because when you're mobilized and fight like an animal, after you get tired and you wind down, then the enemy comes back stronger than he did before. Students spark revolution, and we must work everywhere to have students live up to their responsibility of sparking revolution. Here, of course, it calls for the students properly understanding the role of knowledge. Knowledge has but one purpose. Its purpose is to alleviate the sufferings of humanity. Knowledge has but one purpose. Its purpose is to alleviate the sufferings of humanity. Capitalism is a backward and stupid system. Capitalism is a contemptuous system. Capitalism is a system based on profit. It will make a commodity out of everything. It will take my mother and sell her on a slave block. It will make students acquire knowledge and make them sell their knowledge on the slave block to advance themselves rather than serving humanity. The struggle becomes especially crucial for African students. We say no individual African in this country makes any advance unless it is a result as mass struggle. Any student sitting in any seat in any college in America know that they didn't gain that seat through their own individual talents, but only through the struggles of the masses of their people. Thus, that seat belongs to the people. The knowledge they acquire there must be used for the people. Otherwise, they have already betrayed the people and have repeated errors. Thus, students of the 80s going into the 90s have a responsibility to use their knowledge to help advance the struggles of humanity. We say the lessons here must be properly understood, and the students going to spark these movements must go properly organized in order to bring organizational skills to the masses of the people. The third area. The 1960s, of course, was a mobilized area, and as a mobilized area, there would be a lot of confusion. One of the biggest areas of confusion was the basis of the struggle. Some felt that the base of the struggle must be made by appeals to morality. Of course, anyone knowing anything about struggle knows that this cannot be. Even Frederick Douglass so long ago told us that power concedes nothing without demands. It never did, and it certainly never will. Consequently, what was learned from the struggles of the 60s is that when one comes to struggle, one must struggle for power, not for morality. Certainly, one cannot speak of morality when one is speaking to capitalism. It is an immoral system. It has no conscience. It knows only its own interest. It will commit genocide to take land from the red man. It will commit slavery to enrich itself. It will drop napalm bombs on babies in Vietnam. Consequently, when we come to talk of advancing ourselves through power, we must come to speak of just that. Power. And we must understand that the only place we find power is through the organized masses. Simply put, until the masses of our people are organized, we will remain powerless and thus the victims of all vicious powers that seek to exploit us. The question of morality, of course, must not be put aside, no. But it is clear that any struggling people struggling for justice are already struggling for a moral struggle. Consequently, here, the question of morality doesn't lay with them, but with the enemy who seeks to keep them oppressed. We must then understand clearly that when we look for power in the 90s, when we struggle in the 90s to advance ourselves, we must struggle only based on our own power, the power of the ability to organize our people. Of course, we said that we advance only through mass struggle, and that is clear. Consequently, we must come to understand that It is only through mass organization and conscious mass struggle that we will properly arrive at our liberation in a planned manner. This leads to another point which must be clear, the questions of coalitions. The 1960s, of course, made many errors with coalitions. Here, we believe that political coalitions could be made based on sentiment. Somebody said they feel the way we do, and consequently, we come to organize them. The history, of course, of our people shows that this cannot be the case. If one would go back to the history of the South in this country immediately after the Civil War, there arose at that time a party known as the Populist Party. One of the leaders of the Populist Party was a man by the name of Tom Watson, a white man from Georgia. Watson came after the Civil War to tell the Africans that the rich white man, he exploits the poor white man and the poor African. And consequently, what we need to do is to join an alliance against the rich white man. Well, you know us Africans, we just love anything anybody. We just ran into the party. We filled the party of the populists. We did work for the populists. We were everywhere in the Populist Party. After the Hayes-Tilden Compromise, when the government decided to give the South back to the slave masters, Tom Watson became a member of the Ku Klux Klan and drove us out of the Populist Party. What was the error? The error was that as a force, we were not independently organized, thus not even knowing our own power. We went in as individuals into the party, thus they could chase us out. Examples are to be found everywhere. The struggle of the labor movements in this country is certainly instructive. If one would look at the struggle for labor unions in this country, one would find that Africans have everywhere played a role out of proportion to their numbers. If you look at labor unions today, they are racist from top to bottom. What was the error? Africans came to enter the unions without being first an organized force. The 60s then come here. We were told that we had coalitions with groups I've never heard of, the labor union. We had interests with the church groups, all of them. They were all for our interest. Of course, the error was that some Africans thought that the interest of America was the same as the interest of us. Of course, the job of the system, the job of the enemy is to confuse you and to let you think that your interest and your history is the same as that of your oppressor. As a matter of fact, the job of the master is to convince the slave that the master is really concerned about the interests of the slave. And if the master doesn't do well, the slave will be in trouble. Any slave who believes that he has the same interests as the master will pick cotton at night. All slaves must understand that their interests are diametrically opposed to the interests of the master. Not only are they diametrically opposed, they are antagonisms to each other. What is good for the master is bad for the slave. What's bad for the master is good for the slave. Of course, we said that even the people instinctively understand this, and the 60s come to clarify the point clearly. Of course, if you would look at the 60s, you would see at the height of the struggle for human rights, there came to be some confusion here with the war in Vietnam. The people always see clearly. Instinctively, the people understood, the African masses, that they had to be against the war in Vietnam. There was no question here. But it was in just expression of this position against the war in Vietnam that one came to see that in order to have coalitions, one must really have coalitions based on interest. I am not even talking here of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was really the radical cutting wing of the movement of the 60s, and which was the first one to take a position against the war in Vietnam. Indeed, it did not take a position for peace. It took an anti-imperialist position. It said clearly it wanted the Vietnamese to win, and the way it was going to do that was to demobilize the Americans by not having an army. Thus, the slogan which SNCC gave to them was a simple one: hell no, we won't go. Simple as that. And that simple slogan, of course, came to cause splits within these coalition forces. The labor unions, who walked hands in hands with us for struggles, all of a sudden were for the Vietnam War against us. The church itself had to step back. Obviously, here, we didn't understand what we were fighting for. We thought we were fighting for freedom. And Dr. Martin Luther King said it all the time: freedom is indivisible. As a matter of fact, he used to say all the time, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Consequently, if there's injustice in Vietnam, I'm stupid thinking I'm sitting in America not to think that it affects me. If there's injustice in Vietnam, I better go cut it down before it comes to find me. Consequently, since Africans, assuming that justice was indivisible and began to move and to move everywhere against injustice, they came up against contradictions with those whom they made coalitions around the question of the war in Vietnam. We only use it here as a clear example. Africans cannot form coalitions until they themselves are organized and know exactly what their interests are. Thus, There's no need for us to talk now about coalition with anybody because we are a disorganized people. First, we must become organized. It is for this reason that we're held in such contempt by the Democratic Party, because inside the Democratic Party, we are a disorganized people, even inside there, with one fighting against the other, simply because we have not organized ourselves properly. It is for this reason that they will give us somebody and make us think that we picked them just because he looks like us. Coalitions then can only be formed once we are organized and know precisely what our interests are. What then are the relevancy for the 90s? Revolution is inevitable everywhere in the world, this is clear. And anyone taking just a cursory glance at the United States of America must know that America is more ripe for revolution today than it was in the 60s. What are the conditions that lead us to this conclusion? Number one, the conditions are worse today than they were in the 60s. In the 60s, we didn't have to deal with 3 million homeless. And not only that, the very objective conditions put the people into contradictions with their own instinctive knowledge. Every man and woman in America, even the most unconscious man or woman in America, knows that America has enough wealth to feed and clothe 3 million homeless. It's a question of the will of the people. Consequently, the objective conditions, we say, are higher. But these objective conditions are higher with also another rising factor, the rising consciousness of the people. The enemy tries everywhere through their mouthpiece, the mass media, to make it appear as if the people's consciousness is not growing, as if it stopped. This is stupidity. The consciousness of the people must forever grow. And some of us become confused, not even understanding how it manifests itself. The other day, having a discussion with an elderly man, he came to say to me, Kwame Ture, you're always up on the college campus with our students. I said, oh yes, I work with them all the time. He said, they are more unconscious. They're so unconscious, they're more unconscious than you were when you were a student. I said, never. He said, yes. I said, no, if they're more unconscious than we were, our work was in vain in the 60s. He said, no, I'm telling you, they're more unconscious than you are. I said, no, they cannot be. He said, if you go up on a college campus and talk to them, they know nothing about Martin Luther King, they know nothing about Malcolm X. I said, that's correct. We don't teach them. But one thing is certain, you cannot put them on the back of a bus. Yes, yes, of course. Of course. Of course. Of course. Of course. Conscious he was, he went on the back of the door. Yes. Once history is made, it cannot be unmade. The job of the enemy is to push the people back. Once we broke out of slavery, they did everything possible to push us back into slavery. No, sharecropping, yes, but not slavery. Since the 60s, they've been doing everything else to push us back. But once a man or a woman has learned something, as Sigmund Freud has scientifically demonstrated, it never leaves the mind, even if he thinks he's forgotten it. And once a people have learned something through struggle, never can they forget it. Consequently, the struggles of the 60s must be understood, are already ingrained in the culture of the people, making them more determined to fight, not less. If you come to look properly at America, we say it is more ripe for revolution today than ever before. In the 1960s, and we must show here the rising level of political consciousness. If you want to see the rising level of political consciousness country, don't look to the left, look to the right. The right in America today are involved in activities which in the 1960s they considered to be communist. If you would look properly at America today, you will see the conditions are more ripe. In the 60s, the progressive forces were facing the government and the right wing, which were fighting for status quo. Today, the right wing is not with the government. It's against the government. It's fighting the government. You have the right fighting the government and the left fighting the government. The possibility of change becomes easier, even though the right is not fighting for the same change the left is fighting for. That's understood. But the fact that both of them are fighting against the government makes the possibility of change much easier. And we say, if you want to see the rising level of consciousness, look to the white right in this country. Where they disagree with busing, they burn buses. Where they disagree with abortion, they bomb clinics. Thus, they themselves have come to demonstrate the use of violence as a potent force in arriving at a political objective. Everywhere, the conditions for revolution are more ripe today than ever before. And in all of this is, of course, the rising consciousness of the people. The younger generation of Africans in this country, the youth, really believe that everything in America they have a right to. They believe it as a result of the struggles of the 60s. When they come up against a wall, there's going to be a serious explosion in this country. That explosion cannot be a repetition of the 60s. Indeed, history never repeats itself, even though bourgeois scholars never stop harping this song. Nothing repeats itself, but people, however, can repeat their mistakes, yes. And of course, once you repeat a mistake, it is more grave than the first time around. The lessons then must be clear. There is no question, and you must in no way lose faith in the masses of the people. It is they and they alone who make revolution, not their petty bourgeois spokesmen who betray them everywhere. And the conditions of the masses are worse today than they were in the 60s. These masses must have changed and will have changed by any means necessary. The final point, then. The final point, then. You must not become confused by the American capitalist system, which holds up betrayers of the people's struggle as representatives of the people. In any army in the world, if you desert, you should get shot. It's a law. Certainly, you must be shot. And if you volunteer for an army, you should be shot twice. Of course. You volunteer for the people's army. The people go to fight. They're ready to fight. You say, I'm leaving. What do you mean you're leaving? But if you will look at our struggle since the 60s, you will see nothing but betrayals by the petty bourgeois elements in our society. The African bourgeoisie is the most corrupt bourgeoisie in the world. In Africa, they seek luxury in the midst of mass suffering. There are more Mercedes in Africa than in any other continent in the world. In America, as soon as they arrive at a position based on the blood of the people, they snatch that position and run away from the people. But you must not think that they represent the people. They only represent their opportunistic self, using the people every step of the way. So you must not be confused. It must be clear, then, for the 60s, the class struggle in the African Revolution must be more ruthless and uncompromising than in any other revolution. Here then, the masses must come without pity and without mercy to trample upon these reactionary pigs who, after the people have gained struggle through their blood, come to hand back the gains on a silver platter to the very enemy the people fought. This will come as a natural consequence. The people themselves are everywhere screaming that it's time for them to deal with these reactionary pigs. Even in America, they say, our leaders must be held accountable. They're only saying here that these people must be accountable to those who made it possible for them to get there. Thus, not only is the revolution inevitable, but it is clarifying itself and it is qualifying itself. For the African masses everywhere, the clairpoise position now for class struggle has become inevitable and irreversible. The petty bourgeoisie everywhere will be running for cover, but the masses will spare them not. Consequently, we who have dedicated our lives to the people's struggle, we who knowing that the people will always be free, we understanding that we must make a contribution to qualify our struggle since the 60s, have been dedicating all our energies to only one task, the organization of the masses of our people. The organization of the masses of our people. We are not running for mayor. We're not running for president. No changes can come from the top down. We're not stupid. Changes can only come from the bottom up. The masses and the masses alone can make them. If you want to learn something from the 60s, the lesson is simple. Organize the masses of the people. Thank you. Thank you.
Delivering a present message to us in 1989. Thanks for listening, and we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.